This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Breastfeeding rates have been on the increase in the United States in recent decades. The latest numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say about 80% of women breastfeed their babies, at least initially. But those numbers drop dramatically over time. By a child's first birthday, only about a quarter are still being breastfed. The numbers vary by state, by social status, by race, and parents have a lot of different reasons for the choices that they make. Some women can't breastfeed because of physical complications they or their babies have, or because they've adopted their children. Other women want to but struggle with it. Their babies won't latch, it's painful, etc. Some simply choose not to. And other mothers nurse their babies for as long as they can but have unsupportive workplaces or job and family demands that make breastfeeding or pumping unmanageable. The World Health Organization recommends that babies continue receiving breast milk until their second birthday. And most governmental health organizations encourage breastfeeding, though support can vary. Vermont was just recognized by the U.S. Department of Agriculture for efforts it has made to support breastfeeding among women and children who receive WIC food benefits. Families struggling to make ends meet are less likely than their wealthier contemporaries to start and maintain breastfeeding. Today on the program, we're going to talk a little bit about why breastfeeding is encouraged and what the barriers are. And then in the second half of our discussion, we're going to shift to talk about why this is often a fraught conversation socially and how we can support all parents. Joining me today are Tricia Cassie, the WIC Breastfeeding Coordinator for the Vermont Department of Health, and Jocelyn Adams, who writes for the Burlington, Vermont Moms blog. Tricia and Jocelyn, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting us.
Thank you.
So, Tricia, let's start with you because it was actually WIC, Vermont, a couple of Vermont WIC offices that were recognized by the USDA for efforts to promote breastfeeding in Vermont. So what have you been doing?
Well, Vermont has been doing a lot of work in breastfeeding support, and we believe that breastfeeding is very important for all families and our communities. And we've been recognized by the federal government for our exemplary breastfeeding support, highest in the nation, which is a real honor. And we are so pleased by that. But it really takes a community to breastfeed, and we have a lot of support, not just at WIC and at the health department, but in our hospitals. And our workplaces are really supporting breastfeeding also.
So WIC, for people who don't know or don't remember, is the program for women, infants, and children to support women on limited budgets to be able to have healthy food. So it often supplements with healthy fruits and vegetables and other foods for women and their small children. Why is breastfeeding a priority in that setting?
Well, breastfeeding is really an immune-boosting for babies. It really helps keep them healthy. It helps keep families healthy. It's a wonderful way of saving money, and it just really strengthens the whole community. So breastfeeding support is really crucial, and WIC wants to be the place to go for breastfeeding support because we know that when moms give babies a healthy start in life, that that often reduces health risks in the future.
Jocelyn Adams, Tricia Cassie just said that it takes a community to support breastfeeding mothers and that she thinks Vermont is a supportive community and certainly must be in some ways to have the highest rate of breastfeeding mothers who are in the WIC program in the country. Do you think Vermont is a supportive place for mothers who are feeding their babies, nursing their babies?
I think that if you are nursing and you've chosen to nurse, it definitely is a very supportive community. I know of several different programs and places that I can go with my daughter, my 18-month-old, and I can nurse her and there's never any glares. There's, if anything, what can we do to help and make this better? I do think, though, that sometimes if you choose not to nurse or you're not able to nurse, it can be kind of a scary place to be because the idea I think that a lot of parents in the community feel is that you should breastfeed, it's the best. But if you choose not to, or you have issues, or you wean early, it can kind of feel like you're sort of on the outskirts, at least with a lot of the families that I work with through playgroups or just come in contact with in the community.
So it can be a judgmental place.
It can be. I feel like breastfeeding is probably one of the most personal things that a parent does with their child, really feeding in general. So that could be formula. It can be breast milk. It could be a combination of both. And so it definitely can be a sticking point with parents when they're talking about it. And there can be a lot of judgment that can come out.
Well, and we're going to talk pretty deeply about that in the second half of our conversation. So I'd love to encourage parents who are listening who have some thoughts on that to write in now. You can post your note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or at vpr.net by clicking on Vermont Edition, because you do see a lot of judgment on the mommy blogs and in parenting circles about whether or not you've chosen to breastfeed your child, for how long, why you didn't, whether you should, is formula bad, how long are you I mean, there's just a lot of conversation going on, especially among new parents, on this conversation, and we want to get into that. So again, you can post your notes at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. And we'd also love to hear what choices you have made around breastfeeding or not breastfeeding your infants. And do you feel judged? Is your workplace supportive of women who are breastfeeding or who need to pump at the office? And why do you think this discussion is so charged? How could Vermont do better? Lots to talk about today as we talk about breastfeeding. So I'll give you that number one more time, 1-800-639-2211. So let's talk a little bit about the benefits of breastfeeding and why this is something that is so encouraged by pediatricians and by governmental organizations. Tricia Cassie, what are the benefits to breastfeeding?
Well, the benefits cover more than just the baby. It also affects mom also. But for the baby, the benefits are that it reduces obesity. It helps keep them healthier, builds their immune system. There's less gastrointestinal issues. There's less diabetes for babies that have been breastfed. And so the benefits are lifelong for babies. So we really do encourage moms to breastfeed. And any amount of breastfeeding is a good amount of breastfeeding. Even just feeding for a day helps give that baby some of those immune boosting. So, and benefits for moms also are really important, too. Moms that breastfeed reduce their risk of premenopausal breast cancer and ovarian cancer, and we reduce our risk of metabolic syndrome, of diabetes and heart disease. So those are substantial things to reduce in your life, and breastfeeding really protects.
There was a study that came out in February of 2014, and it was published in the journal Social Science and Medicine. And it looked at sibling pairs where one sibling had been breastfed and the other hadn't. And that study found that it was statistically insignificant in terms of some of the benefits that have been found to the baby for being breastfed. And the critique that they were making of other studies was that the other studies that often look at breastfeeding benefits don't take into account some of the other factors in families. So by looking at pairs where one child was breastfed and the other wasn't, but presumably the rest of the family's income and other issues were the same, what they found was that the benefits may have been overstated over the years. Is that something that you've looked at and have a thought on?
Well, you know, most of the research out there is very, very clear that breastfeeding has some real good advantages, or rather that not breastfeeding puts moms and babies at risk. So we really do promote breastfeeding. It looks very clear that the evidence supports breastfeeding as being the normal way to breastfeed a baby and the most beneficial start in life.
So you don't think that it's other socioeconomic factors that often go along with people choosing not to breastfeed that are the bigger issue here? You think breastfeeding really is a benefit regardless of what other kind of start in life you're getting?
Well, certainly some of those other factors do enter in. Of course they do. But breastfeeding, we believe that breastfeeding really helps mitigate some of the effects of poverty in those early days. And so that breastfeeding can really help both mom, babies, and families and communities.
Jocelyn Adams, did you find in the Burlington, Vermont Moms blog that was a topic of conversation when that study came out?
I don't know if that study in particular was. And I do think that one of the things that we're working on with Burlington, Vermont Moms blog is trying to reach more moms. I would say that in general, we are probably hitting more middle class to upper class parents. And so we've been trying to figure out how to branch out and get more of the community. But I would say that with regards to that study, and I'm obviously not a nurse or anything scientific, but I would say overall, my 18-month-old Caroline, she has been very rarely sick. We never really had a lot of the colic and incessant crying that a lot of children can have. She definitely is a pretty happy child, and I would think a lot of that has to come from nursing. That's not to say that she just had a better disposition when she was born, a happier disposition. But overall, we really think that with regards to not getting sick, that when Dr. Hagen, Reinhardt, and Conley, that's our pediatrician, tells us that it has a lot to do with the antibodies and that I'm being exposed to the same things that she is and she's getting that from my breast milk, I have to think that that has some bearing on what we've seen with her.
So what went into your decision then to decide to breastfeed your child and then to continue?
So to be honest, it was never a decision to breastfeed. So I actually was raised in New Hampshire with my mom, and I have three younger brothers, and we were pretty low income, and my mom had been involved with WIC in New Hampshire, and she ended up being a WIC volunteer and maybe doing some of what we're talking about today. But we were all breastfed, and so from very early on, that was the norm, and so it just made sense. It wasn't a matter of will I formula feed. It was just we were going to breastfeed. And I know from previous work that I did before I decided to stay at home with Caroline through the Department for Children and Families is that a lot of parents end up going with what their mothers did and what their grandmothers did. And so for us, it wasn't even something we thought about. It was just that was the norm. And so that's what we were going to do.
Listeners, I'd love to hear from you on this conversation, where you stand, how you made choices for your family. And in particular, we're going to talk a little bit about the barriers that some parents and mothers in particular feel around continuing to breastfeed. Maybe your office doesn't feel like a very welcoming place, despite the laws that require offices to have spaces for women to breastfeed or to pump. Maybe that doesn't feel like an option for you. And so if you're struggling with this, if you've wanted to breastfeed for longer than you did but felt like you couldn't, you can tell us your story, or if you just have a comment or a question to leave, or if you chose to formula feed, we'd love to know your thinking and why you did that, and if you feel that kind of pressure or judgment that Jocelyn was talking about. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from Brian who says, I would think that a big step in encouraging and supporting moms who choose to breastfeed would be to stop demonizing moms who don't. So Brian thinking there about some of that judgment. And let's go to Michael calling in from Plainfield. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi, Jen. Thanks for having me on. I wanted to first say in context that my daughter's mother was a Lamaze instructor, and that I worked also myself extensively with Patrick Cantonio, who was in Africa, part of a big campaign against Nestle's push to have all women use formula and instead encourage breastfeeding in Africa. So from that place, I could also say that our daughter chose to wean herself at about 10 or 11 months. And since we were a low-income family, that presented a possibility which I took to do home care, which I probably wouldn't have been able to do if she didn't wean. And that was important because we were a two-earner family. And in her workplace, which was a college environment, she was able to nurse our daughter while she was nursing until she weaned herself without any thing but support. But I know that other women that we worked with and that we also met and knew personally who were working low income or semi-skilled or like working Walmart or McDonald's or construction jobs, certainly because of their income, were not encouraged at the workplace and had to wean their children maybe before they wanted to, because otherwise they couldn't return to work and they were forced. And these are not women who read blogs and barely have access to the internet. So it would be primarily those people, I think, who would have the most difficulty.
Michael, thanks for your call and thanks for sharing your experiences with the decisions that you made for your family. Tricia Cassie, Michael saying there that some women do have a really hard time when they return to work. continuing to breastfeed for various reasons. Can you explain the law, the federal law and the Vermont law, and then, you know, what pressures that mothers do face, even if the law says they're allowed to breastfeed or continue pumping at the office?
Yes, absolutely, because going back to work is one of those barriers that really hit moms, and it makes breastfeeding very challenging sometimes. So a supportive work environment with family-friendly policies is really critical to mom's success. So we have two laws. The Vermont law came first, actually, and that law says that employers need to provide an appropriate time and space for moms to pump. The time is not specified because it varies from mom to mom, and the place needs to be other than a bathroom, but it's not necessary to have a dedicated room or a lactation space. It can be a floating office or a conference room that's not being used, just some place that mom feels that she can pump her milk in privacy that is free from intrusion from her coworkers. The federal government, along with the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, enacted some provisions there that cover all wage and hour employees throughout the U.S., and those mothers are able to pump and express their breast milk for up to a year after the baby is born. And again, it's supposed to be an appropriate place and not a bathroom and an appropriate time. So the federal law also says that if your state law is stronger, then you need to follow that. And Vermont's law allows moms to pump for up to 3 years following the birth of their baby. And I do see moms pumping beyond a year, though most moms don't pump much more beyond that.
But do you have experiences, both of you, talking with mothers who find that a struggle, that the law may be supportive? And in many cases, employers are supportive, but it can be difficult. I mean, just speaking from experience, it was hard for me to find time to pump, even in an office where that was supported and encouraged. And if you're working shift work, if you're, say, a waitress and your breaks are very short, you may not have the time to get everything set up and pump and complete your pumping cycle. It may be feeling like it's pressure to you, which can inhibit the milk from coming down. So, I mean, you must find moms who say, that's great that the law's in place, but I'm still finding it too difficult.
Oh, Jane, yes, you talk about some good points there, and we do hear that. It is a challenge to go back to work and pump, and there are many challenges. They may be an unsupportive work environment, and that's definitely a challenge. But the employer may be very supportive, and yet mom has just a hectic, busy schedule. Sometimes we have little time for doing the pumping, and so the pressure may be more internal, but it's still there. And so that can feel like a real barrier. So we need to create as much family-friendly environments at work that we can to support all families to do this, because the statistics and research show that babies that are breastfed are sick less often. Those moms don't miss as much work as moms that have babies that are formula fed and in daycare. You got to build up your immunities at some point, so babies do get some germs. And, you know, those moms have more illness, and so they need to take more time off of work. And that's very disruptive. The planned time to pump is a disruption in the day, but it is a planned and expected disruption. And so it's easier to work around than those, you know, stretches of sick days that you might have with a baby.
We should also just mention that I believe federal law now requires insurance companies to provide a pump for women who are going to be returning to work after they've had a baby. And I think it has to be free, right? So that your insurance company should be covering that.
Yes, private insurance will cover a breast pump for moms going back to work. And most of those plans are now covering that at this point.
Medicaid and Medicare don't?
Medicaid does not.
Medicaid, right.
Medicaid does not in Vermont. So the moms that need a pump and are on Medicaid may be eligible for a hospital-grade rental pump if their baby has a medical necessity. And then they're also eligible for WIC, and WIC can offer moms going back to work or school a breast pump at no cost. And so that's one of the real benefits of being on WIC, is we support breastfeeding and we actually help them with a breast pump.
Jocelyn, is this a topic of conversation among the moms that you chat with?
So I think that even going beyond just the workplace and if it's supportive or not supportive, I do think that regarding feeding in public, so breastfeeding in public or pumping in public, even if you have an office or whatnot, I do think that there is a certain level of confidence that you have to have, because even though you know that it is your right to breastfeed in any public setting or at work, it can still be really difficult. I'm actually thinking of one instance where I was at Evolution Yoga, which, if you haven't been there before, there it's a wonderful space to do baby yoga, to do prenatal, but they're very, very welcoming of nursing. And there was a mom who came for the first time, and she asked me if it was okay if she breastfed in the waiting room, which is exactly what that room is meant for. And I was a little caught off guard, and I said, "Of course you can." And it through a conversation, it was very clear that she's always wanting to make sure that she's not making anyone else feel uncomfortable, where I think that I felt that very soon after Caroline was born. But I got to a certain point that I just don't care anymore. I don't. I want to make sure that to be honest, I breastfed Caroline one time in a public bathroom, and I said, "I will never do this again." And so, you know, I don't know how my husband always feels about it, but I will pull out my breast and I will feed her anywhere. But it does take some confidence and having to have kind of a thick skin, because you do get looks sometimes, especially from the older generation, I feel. And so even at a workplace where they are supportive, you know that you may be taking a space from someone else who might need it, or that you're making someone wait for another meeting. And I'm just throwing it out there, if I was working at McDonald's, I can't really think of how much space there probably is. And I'm probably making everyone else feel very shorthand that I'm every couple of hours going to pump. And so there's that pressure on you as well. And I think that could really play into your decision to continue breastfeeding or not.
Well, and that's a great point, because that's exactly where we're about to go here. We're going to take a quick break, and more of your calls and emails coming up. If you'd like to weigh in here, if you'd like to tell a story, or if you just have a question or an anecdote to share, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're going to be talking about that sort of social pressure, social judgment, the feelings that people have. We posted on our Facebook page in advance of the show, as we always do. And one of the questions that we were asking was, how can you support breastfeeding mothers? And one of the first comments we got was from somebody who said, ask to have the other boob. You know, so there is this sort of hypersexualization even in breastfeeding that we're going to be talking about coming up. So stay with us. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking about breastfeeding. Vermont law is very supportive of breastfeeding, and the state was recently recognized for higher than average rates. But state policy aside, mothers often talk amongst themselves about the pressure surrounding breastfeeding and the damned if you do, damned if you don't feeling they sometimes get, regardless of what choice they make for feeding their infants. It's one battlefront in the mommy wars, where judgment and guilt combine to isolate moms and make them feel defensive about their choices. Using formula, don't you know that breast is best? Breastfeeding in public, why do you have to flaunt that in my face? Go cover yourself up. Maybe you're uncomfortable breastfeeding in public. Well, you could get a response that says you're caving to the misogynist pressure and not supporting women. Some moms feel like they just can't win no matter what they do. And they may also privately admit to judging other moms just a teeny tiny bit themselves. So we're going to focus a little on why this is so controversial for the second part of our discussion today. We're talking with Tricia Cassie, WIC breastfeeding coordinator for the Vermont Department of Health, and Jocelyn Adams, who writes for the Burlington, Vermont Moms blog. And we're hearing from some of you as well. If you want to weigh in, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Stefania posts, the most natural way and only purpose of the breast is to feed the babe. Why is there any question about that? Sarah suggests provide lots of support in those first days. That is when the most difficulty occurs, especially if you're a first-time mom, and she says normalize it. Molly in Bradford agrees. She says, I think we're in the middle of another culture shift, or more cynically, a trend shift. Breastfeeding and other normal behaviors should never be in the realm of trend, nor should it be considered obscene in any way. Newborn feeding should be taught in school just like any other normal subject. When we ignore it, we allow mainstream media to fill in the gaps and teach our children that breasts are strictly sexual. And Honor has a story for us. She says, yesterday, my three-week-old started yelling in line at the Springfield Shaw's checkout. As soon as I had bagged my groceries, I sat on the indoor bench that faces the registers and I nursed him. I expected at least some askance looks, and I braced myself for a negative comment as the dozens of people walked by. None came. Instead, I got some aw faces, one good job, and a wonderful woman who told me that I had a beautiful family. I am still glowing, she says. And then she says, this is a long way of saying that I think Vermont is doing well in supporting breastfeeding. Also, happy Black Breastfeeding Week. And it is Black Breastfeeding Week. Black mothers have a lower rate of breastfeeding, so there's a push right now and this week in particular to support Black mothers in breastfeeding. And let's go to some of our calls. Janet is on the line with us from Burlington. Hi, Janet. Go right ahead.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you're having this conversation. I was one of those moms that was really disappointed to hear the advice that was on that etiquette podcast that seemed to indicate mothers should isolate themselves when breastfeeding in public. So I really appreciate you having this conversation. And I'm somebody who's just finishing up breastfeeding my second baby and was working the entire time. And I just want to reiterate the fact that you do have to have a lot of confidence and you have to advocate for yourself. And it's really hard sometimes. You have to say every time, hey, I need that break in that meeting to be a 20-minute break, not a 10-minute break, if you want me to participate. I have to go all around the state for my job, and I have to walk right in every place I go and say, I'm going to need a place to pump. I'm a nursing mom. I need a place to pump. And whether or not that's, you know, the guy in the kitchen who's at that hotel for an early start, or whether or not it's, a funding partner or somebody like that, you have to ask for that space every time, and it's a lot of work. And it's really challenging. I've pumped in the backseat of my boss's car while we've been driving, and he's a guy. I just had to do a ton of stuff. So it's really hard. And so I would just say that we just all need to treat each other with, you know, compassion and then help each other build up each other's confidence. Because it can be really tough, but we're all, you know, on the same team trying to, you know, develop healthy babies. But that confidence that she was talking about is really important. But again, compassion for people that can't necessarily breastfeed. And a huge piece of this, too, I think, is those moms who don't have the financial means to stay home for very long to sort of establish their breastfeeding routine, you know, that are pressured to go back into work, you know, 2 or 3 weeks after the baby starts, after the baby's born. That's a real issue regarding breastfeeding as well.
Janet, thanks for your call and thanks for sharing your stories. Appreciate that. And Janet, really echoing what Jocelyn, you had been saying about that confidence that you need to have in order to feel comfortable in public and to advocate for yourself and for your needs. Let's take a few more calls and then I want to get your thoughts in here as we listen to our callers. Brenda's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Brenda.
Hey, Jane. How are you?
Great.
So my story is I was in the Boston area when I was nursing both of my children, who are now in high school, and I nursed my daughter till she was 4 and my son till he was 2.5. And in terms of just sort of the social reaction, even my own mom kind of got uncomfortable, especially with the daughter who went to age 4 because she was speaking and she could actually ask to nurse. She would tell me when she wanted to switch. And my mother would say, hey, if she can talk, you got to stop that because she didn't nurse herself. Three brothers and I were all born in the 50s and 60s, and formula was sort of a great innovation. So she didn't and was really uncomfortable. So, I mean, even in your own family, you can get sort of a negative response, although I was lucky because in Boston, I think for the most part, people were pretty progressive. But I say power to the breastfeeders. I have smart kids, and I'm really happy I did it.
Brenda, thank you so much for calling in. Appreciate that. Michelle is on the line with us from Plainfield. Hi, Michelle. What's your story?
Hi. So I have a kind of a compromise story. I breastfed 35 years ago, and I was really my husband and I were really into it, and I did have flexibility. So I breastfed for 3 months, and I wasn't crazy about it. It was okay. I didn't really like being the food of someone else, but anyway, whatever. I did it, and then at 3 months, we put her on one bottle a day so that I could go to work. I don't exactly remember. And Sam, my husband, was able to give her the bottle. So that had that was formula. And so I didn't have to, well, I wouldn't have occurred to me to pump at that point. And so I had more freedom. And then he could be feeding the baby. And we did that till she was 10 months. So I think she maybe had a bottle during the day when I was at work, and then maybe one in the evening, and then I breastfed the rest of the time. And it seemed to me it was a very good compromise with what people were talking about having to pump all the time. I couldn't imagine that myself. And also then the father can be more involved.
Michelle, thank you. That's such an interesting point, and I want to direct it back to our guests today because, you know, you bring up this idea of formula feeding and breastfeeding together and in conjunction, and that's a choice that a lot of parents make. But it's interesting to me that so far you're the only woman who's called in and said, I formula fed my children. And I think there is a lot of guilt, a lot of judgment, a lot of pressure that mothers feel who do use formula. And Jocelyn, you brought that up as something that you wanted to make sure wasn't stigmatizing to moms because there are a lot of choices to make. And you think moms shouldn't feel guilty about the choices that they make for their families.
Absolutely. So part of the Burlington Vermont Moms blog is it's a team of writers. And so just to give kind of a spectrum, we have one mom who has eloquently written before about her choice not to breastfeed all three of her daughters. And it was a beautifully written, just really expressing her reasons for why she made the decision she did. And then we have a woman on our team who is, I believe, still breastfeeding. She's either three or four, and she's currently pregnant. And she puts on the big Latch On event every year that happens throughout the country. And so we have women who are completely across the spectrum. And I want to go back to something that Rachel said. She used the word compassion. And I think that with anything that has to do with feeding our children, which is such a personal thing, is that we do have to have compassion for one another. And that we have to consider that women are making the best decisions for them and their children. And that we have to respect that. And I have a cousin who formula feeds her daughter. Her daughter is just over a year old, and they formula fed from, I'm pretty sure, the very beginning. And there are some pros and cons with both of them. My daughter's 18 months. My husband put her to bed two nights ago, and it was the first time he was able to really put her down without her screaming because she won't take breast milk from a bottle. And that was like a big deal 18 months after she was born, where parents who are bottle feeding either breast milk or formula, usually those things can happen more 50-50. The dad has a chance or the partner has a chance to really like do the feedings, put the baby to bed. And so I think that we have to just go back to compassion and exactly what we've been talking about being a community and being supportive, because I agree. I don't remember the second caller, but I think that if we are going in at the very beginning and being a very supportive community and providing the support, people are going to probably may be more likely to breastfeed or maybe not, but they'll feel like they had the choice, which I think is what's really important.
But you must find, I mean, I have found that there are a lot of parents out there. I mean, this goes for anybody in any realm of discussion, but particularly in this sort of high pressure conversation around parenting choices, whether it's, you know, cloth diapering versus regular diapers, disposable diapers, or working mom versus not working mom, you know, whatever the conversation is in these mommy wars, you often find parents who say, I would never judge another parent, but.
Right.
And so, you know, this idea that I'm not being judgmental, but I can't believe she's doing that.
Exactly. And those words have come out of my mouth before. I mean, if we're honest, we all have these thoughts. And I think part of it is, as parents, is that before I was a mother, I thought of myself maybe as a professional, as a woman, as a daughter, as a wife. But now the thing that comes to the forefront is mother. And so if I want to believe that everything I'm doing for my daughter is right, and if someone else is doing something different, I want to internally or whatnot might want to believe that that's not right. Because if they're doing it and it's working, how does that make sense for me as a mom? And I think that's where it comes from. But I think it goes with any kind of acceptance is that you really just need to take a step back, breathe, and realize that child is probably just doing just as well as your child, and they're making different decisions, but that's okay.
You know, interestingly, we got a note from Karen who says, I'm nearly 65 and I nursed both of my children in Vermont in the 1970s. There was not only no support from the public, there was none within my family either, except for my husband. But Karen says, I do feel a little bit offended that one of your guests seems to think that the negative reactions are coming from my generation. Please know that those who went before you had a more challenging time than you might imagine. You know, just interesting to think about all that idea of compassion and understanding people's different perspectives. Tricia Cassie, where do you come in on this? And what do you think is needed to be more supportive of parents?
Well, first, I think it's very important to support a mom's decision, whatever that may be. We need to support her in her decision, and it needs to fit for her family. So whatever decision she makes, we want to support her as a healthcare provider. There are lots of ways for partners to support moms also. They doesn't necessarily have to be feeding the baby. There's lots of other supports that partners can do. Babies often need to be held for a while after nursing. They don't fall into a deep sleep right away. And that handoff to a partner who can hold that baby and cuddle that sleeping baby until the baby's in a deep sleep can be very helpful so mom can take a nap and rest. We need to mother the mother so she can mother her baby. And whatever works for her in her community, in having that community support is helpful. We need more baby-friendly hospitals. The baby-friendly hospitals know about the good maternity care practices that really support. A baby-friendly hospital is really a mother-friendly hospital because they have a lot of good supportive policies. And we have one baby-friendly hospital in Vermont and a couple of others on the way to pathway to becoming baby-friendly.
So that's an actual, I mean, not exactly a certification, but it's a thing that hospitals do?
Yes, it certainly is. And they go through a whole accreditation process. And it's pretty extensive.
And what's the hospital that is baby friendly?
NVRH up in St. Johnsbury. So they're a baby-friendly hospital since, I believe, it's been at least 10 years. 1999, I think, is when they came on. So
you'd like to see more of that in the state, more of that friendly practices right from the beginning when a baby is born.
Absolutely. You know, we have a very supportive state here in Vermont, but there's always room for improvement in every community, in every hospital, in every health department. So we're always striving to improve and to support our moms even more, all of the moms, whatever choice they make.
Well, I want to thank both of you for having this conversation with us. It's one that often happens online, on blogs, on Facebook groups, and in specific small conversations, but it's nice to open it up and have this sort of aired out in the public. I appreciate both Tricia and Jocelyn, you guys being a part of this today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Tricia Cassie is the WIC breastfeeding coordinator for the Vermont Department of Health, and Jocelyn Adams writes for the Burlington, Vermont Moms blog. And we want to encourage you to carry on the conversation. We've got one going on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, or you can go to vpr.net and click on today's Vermont Edition to tell us your story. Coming up, a diver finds what she's spent 30 years looking for, but this tiny petroglyph has many more mysteries still to reveal. We'll hear from master diver Annette Spaulding next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last month, master diver Annette Spaulding was under the surface of the Connecticut River when a small rock carving materialized in the murky water in front of her. Crying into her mask, she realized it was the petroglyph she had been searching for the past 30 years. Annette Spaulding joins me now to talk about her find. Annette, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Good afternoon. What a beautiful day today.
Yes, isn't it? And I want you to take us out from the sunshine and dive under the water.
Absolutely, because that's where I usually am. I don't think I'll ever have a suntan. So
yes, take us under and what it was like when this petroglyph appeared to you. What did it look like, and what were you doing underwater?
Okay, so for about 30 years off and on, I have been searching, in between other things I've been searching for a large rock called Indian Rock. It's been underwater since the dam went in 1909. Very significant. Five eagles are engraved on this rock, along with a person, what appears to be maybe a dog or a wolf, and two eels or snakes. And it's a large wall, about 12 feet long, 8 feet wide. And I've been searching for this. There's no definite description of exactly where it is. So I've covered a lot of area. I've moved a lot of silt by hand and a lot of sand and mud, hundreds of pounds. I feel like a construction worker instead of a diver at times. But anyway, in search of this large, there's two sites, this larger one I'm looking for, and also a recording back in 1806 and 1807 of a petroglyph, a single petroglyph, that was on a significant rock that has also been lost underwater for more than 100 years. So in my search, I really thought that these eagles are 8 inches long and about 5 inches wide, and they're deeply engraved. And I really thought that I would find that first. But I was really shocked. I was getting low on air. I was near the end of my dive. And I started fanning another whole area, another whole ledge of the area that I've been searching for many years. And all of a sudden, I saw these two beautiful white horizontal lines that were just really amazing. They were white quartz, about an inch and a half wide, but they almost look like waves on the water or the river or an ocean. And I thought to myself, wow, these are really significant, beautiful white quartz lines. And just as I'm running out of air, getting low, I thought, I'm going to keep fanning here. I'm going to keep looking. And my face was only about 6 inches from the stone because the visibility was so bad for me stirring it up and looking. And all of a sudden, right before my face, as the silt settled for a moment, I have this single petroglyph staring back at me. I couldn't believe it. I was so excited to find this. I can't even believe I found this one before I found the other big one. But this was really a significant find to me. This was a more shallow hammer stone, a little bit more shallow in the stone than what I am looking for, what I've been looking for. This was the other site that was mentioned in 1806 and 1807, and I was thrilled to find it. It's very, very similar. This particular one is very similar to the ones in Bellows Falls, Vermont. Beautiful petroglyphs there, the round faces, the two little either feathers or antennas, but I believe they're supposed to symbolize feathers. And it's very similar to that one, where the larger petroglyph site that I'm looking for is very, very different. There's no round faces on it. There's eagles and the person. And so this one, the mystery is how old it is. Was it made by the same people that did the ones in Bellows Falls? But it was such an exciting find for me. And I every day when I can go down in the evenings and dive, and on weekends I've been diving, and this past weekend I dove looking so intensely for, I just feel closer and closer to the big one, and I'm really excited about it.
Annette, you're like an underwater female Indiana Jones. It's really fabulous to hear you describe what it's like to look for these. And just to catch people up here, I mean, this is, as you mentioned, a petroglyph that had been written about, so it was known, and it was not submerged initially, but it was in 1909 when the river was dammed down below, and so this petroglyph went underwater, and so you've been trying to find it. As you said, it's a face. It's got two eyes. It's got these things that may represent feathers, but it's small. It's only about 6 inches long or 6 inches around. So what happens to the petroglyph now that you've found it?
Well, the first thing that I did, other than being so excited, I notified the state archaeologist in Montpelier. And his name is Jess Robinson. And he was aware that it was recorded that this existed, but no one, again, knew. It was never documented exactly where this was, and nobody has seen it for more than 100 years. So I took photos of it for Jess, and it is now recorded in the state archives. I've talked to a number of wonderful historians and historical societies and interested people in the last few weeks, and it's going to be, I believe that the silt has protected it underwater. The silt that fills into it and filled in the little face has protected this from abrasion, maybe from wind. It's pretty protected under there. So for non-divers, people can look at it, you know, by my video that I did take. A good friend of mine, Amy Maurer, underwater photographer, came this weekend, and I took her out to show it to her, and she photographed did a lot of photographs for me for some presentations I'll be doing for Historical Society study next week. But I videotaped some with my GoPro that I have, and they came out pretty good. And I think possibly Amy's going to help me just post those on maybe online so people can get the feeling of what it looked like to clear that rock and see that for the first time. And they can see the white lines that I'm talking about. And that's really important to me to share with people that don't dive what I saw that they would that they have interest in. And that means so much to me and children and schools. It's critical.
Well, and to try to figure out maybe exactly who made this petroglyph and why and what it exactly represents, a lot still to uncover, even though you have now found this stone carving itself. Annette Spaulding is a master diver who lives in Rockingham, and she's been telling us about a submerged petroglyph in the Connecticut River near Brattleboro that she found after searching on and off for it for the past 30 years. Annette, congratulations, and thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you. And it's funny you mentioned Indiana Jones. So many of my friends call me Indiana Jones.
Well, Indiana Jones / Annette Spaulding, what a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, and that does it for today. Now, with the kids back in school, the last thing parents want to hear is that their child is being bullied or harassed. Tomorrow on the program, we'll discuss what steps you should take when your children tell you they're targets of school-based aggression. Send your comments or questions to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy and Sarah Matthews. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.